Individual Freedom versus Madigan. Mr. Kirby.
May it please the Court. The clerk's office asked me to mention that due to the reduction in time, I'm reserving 3 minutes for rebuttal instead of five.
That's fine.
This appeal has to do with how the Illinois campaign finance statutes were written, not with what they seek to achieve. The Supreme Court has held that the government may require disclosure in connection with certain speech relating to elections. We don't dispute that here, but the Supreme Court has also held that such statutes requiring disclosure impose a substantial burden on First Amendment rights, and therefore those statutes have to be drafted in the way that the First Amendment requires.
Well, you know, the primary issue that you raise is whether Article 9 is facially vague.
Yes, ma'am, whether it is facially vague or whether it is otherwise facially imprecise. That's correct.
And, of course, usually we say the statute is facially vague only when there's no set of circumstances under which the statute would be valid or when the statute lacks any plainly legitimate sweep. Do you agree that's the standard that we should apply here? And if you don't, would you state what you believe the correct standard to be?
Yes, Your Honor. It is not the correct standard. There is an exception to all of the cases announcing the standard that the Court proposed for circumstances in which there is a First Amendment intrusion. And when there's a violation of the First Amendment rights, when there's a burden of First Amendment rights, then you ask whether the problem, the overbreadth or the vagueness, is substantial in light of the legitimate sweep of the statute, both substantial in a qualitative sense and substantial in a quantitative sense. Here, of course, the vagueness that we're talking about, Your Honor, is in the core standards that the statute applies. We're not talking about a peripheral issue that might arise someday out of the corner of the park where you can't tell quite where the softball grounds begin and the football grounds end. We're talking about core problems with deciding whether or not the most highly protected kind of speech is or is not to be regulated. This is central vagueness, not peripheral vagueness. This is substantial, and we have the uncontested affidavit of our expert, Professor Smith, who talks about how entities like my client, the Center for Individual Freedom, acting independently of any candidate or any campaign, want to speak but are suppressing their speech precisely because of the vagueness and overbreadth that we challenge here. And that statute, for that reason, Your Honor, we submit, is facially overbroad and is facially vague and is facially invalid.
Mr. Kirby, why don't the time limits for electioneering communication solve most of these problems? Most of us have a pretty good sense of what it means to support or oppose a candidate or a ballot initiative. And the restrictions here, as I understand them, the central ones anyway, apply only in the 30 days before a primary election and 60 days before a general election.
A few of them do. Many of them do not, Your Honor. That's the first concern we have with that. It's only the ones that are tied to the electioneering communication aspect of the problem that have the 60-30 days. But suppose the legislature wanted to say, everybody who engages in political speech within 60 days of an election must disclose everything about their finances. That would never be sustainable, and that's not what Illinois has tried to do. Illinois has tried to say, if you're within 60 or 30 days, depending on whether it's a general or a primary, and you do various other things, and you support or oppose a candidate, what does that mean? If you advocate publicly issues that the candidate has identified himself with, are you supporting the candidate? If you advocate against issues the candidate has embraced, are you opposing the candidate? Do you have to actually indicate that people should do something, vote or not vote? I don't know, and I've been practicing in this arena for 20 years now, Your Honor, what it means to say that speech supports or opposes a candidate. I do know this. I've been before ethics boards across this country that have very strange and very unpredictable views as to when an ad supports or opposes a candidate. And I'm sorry to say, it often depends to some extent on the philosophical sympathies of those regulators. And what the First Amendment requires instead is something that doesn't turn on that. The support or oppose standard, Your Honor, gets to one of the three critical points I want to make here today during my oral argument. And that is that since Buckley, and indeed before Buckley, but clarified in Buckley, the First Amendment will not tolerate what the Supreme Court calls an intent or effect test. That's a test where the speaker has to judge how a regulator will judge the speaker's intent in speaking or the effect that the speech will have on the audience. And the Supreme Court in Buckley in the 40s somewhere, and then again in the 60s and 70s, pointed out that that kind of test that requires the speaker to make that kind of judgment blankets with uncertainty the entire regulatory regime and leads the speaker to self-censor, to hedge, trim, steer clear, to avoid the risk that some regulator is going to infer that his intent or infer that the likely message implied by his speech is one that's going to trigger regulation. And so that's one of the three critical points I want to make here today, is that that kind of standard.
Why don't you tell us what your other two critical points
are
before you get interrupted further? So.
Well, Your Honor, I want to talk to what the court wants to know about, so obviously I don't object to being interrupted.
This is just friendly advice given our court.
The second point that I want to make very clearly is that there is no question here that this kind of disclosure requirement is a substantial burden on First Amendment speech. The Supreme Court has said that in Buckley. It said that repeatedly since that time. I often encounter people who have read the cases to think that unless you show that somebody is going to lose his job or be the target of a boycott or run out of town on a rail, something like the NAACP cases, that you don't have a substantial burden on speech. But that's not correct. Buckley pointed out the disclosure itself is a substantial burden on speech. It proceeded then to apply stringent First Amendment scrutiny.
Why is the burden of disclosure severe when compared with the public interest in knowing who's funding election-related advocacy? I mean, haven't the enormous sums of money that have been spent by purportedly independent political action committees in the recent elections demonstrated the need for greater transparency, the need for greater accountability?
The Supreme Court agrees with you. And that's why the Supreme Court has said disclosure statutes are permissible. They've said that a number of times.
You just want the statute to be the same as the federal statute, which the Supreme Court upheld, right?
No, Your Honor. We want the statute to be clear.
Why don't you want it to be? I don't understand.
It would be wonderful if it were.
The Supreme Court has upheld a disclosure statute. Why shouldn't Illinois just adopt the same language?
That would be one approach, Your Honor, and that's sort of half what they.
What's wrong with it? Why isn't it the right approach?
Your Honor, if
it's a safe harbor, right?
It is a safe harbor.
The Supreme Court says it's okay. So why doesn't Illinois just adopt that?
That would be one solution.
That takes care of your concerns and their concerns.
It does, Your Honor. But I don't want to be heard here saying today that the only...
Why not? Why don't you just say, let's eliminate all this doubt and all this semantic stuff. Just use the statutory language that the Supreme Court has blessed, right? Then there's no legal issues anymore, right?
That is one solution to the problem.
That's the only solution, right? Because every other solution, you're going to be haggling over these semantic issues. What does in connection mean? What does concert mean?
I agree that those are very difficult issues, Your Honor, and that
why involve ourselves with difficult issues when there's a simple solution?
Your Honor, if I were a state legislator, I would do exactly what you have suggested. But I don't have to persuade this court that that's the only permissible approach for Illinois to take.
You have your own draft?
I do not.
Well, then forget it, right? What good is it? We should send it back so you can haggle with the other side about language? What's
Your
that
Honor,
point? What's the point of that?
I don't want to haggle with language.
Well,
I want.
You should have presented us with a text.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it. It's emphatically.
Yeah, it's your burden. Present. Look, if you don't like this, tell us what you do like.
Well, with all respect, Your Honor.
Tell us you don't like that.
Your Honor.
They go back, they draft something else, come back, have another lawsuit. I don't see that.
Your Honor, my obligation at most.
Your obligations provide a better text. If there's no better text, then we'll uphold this text.
The Supreme Court has said over and over again that where you encounter vagueness or overbreadth, it is not the duty of the court to rewrite the statute, but simply to strike it down again.
I don't agree with you. I think it's your duty to present a superior text.
Well, Your Honor, I can't.
Otherwise, we'll just be bouncing this back to the Illinois legislature, them to fuss over, right?
Well, one superior text, as the court points out, and one that we would welcome.
It's the only, alternative we have, right?
It's the federal standard. And certainly Illinois has certainly defendants, neither through the legislature nor in this case. Illinois has not presented a text that avoids these very fundamental vagueness and overbreadth problems. As you point out.
They're incompetent, so they should have used the federal standard. They can't.
Well, Your Honor.
I don't know how to draft.
I don't want to quarrel with. I just don't want to stand up here and ask this, assume the burden of showing that the Illinois legislature is incompetent. I'm not going to quarrel with the court's observations, but I don't think I have to establish that in order to prevail on the proposition that the language that they did enact does have this intent or effect defect in it that prevents speakers from knowing confidently whether or not their speech is going to be regulated and whether or not they're going to incur the burdens of being classified as a political committee, which the Supreme Court has pointed out, are indeed substantial burdens. So that was my second point. My third point is that we are not limited here. I believe that light means that I'm going into my rebuttal time.
Yeah.
And may it please the court, I would like to reserve my rebuttal time.
Sure.
Why don't you tell us what your third point is before the other side has to speak?
All right. Yeah. The third point was that although we have focused on vagueness here, there also is an overbreadth problem in that the burdens of political committee status, equivalent to federal political committee status, are imposed on groups that do not have the primary purpose of electing or defeating a candidate. And the Supreme Court has made clear that going that far simply can't be justified. That is the respect in which my argument is not simply a vagueness argument, but it's a you can't justify the imprecision argument.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kirby. Ms. Wells?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the State Board of Elections.
The legislature just used the federal standard.
Well, in fact, Your Honor, that's pretty much what the legislature did.
Pretty much. Why didn't it do it? Why didn't it do it there? I think it's a very badly drafted statute.
Again, Your Honor, in McConnell, the Supreme Court held that the refer to a clearly identified candidate,
yeah,
60 days.
My question, why didn't the legislature just use the federal standard that the Supreme Court has blessed?
Well, with regard to electioneering communications in particular, it did.
Answer my question.
It did.
No, you didn't. Why didn't it adopt the federal standard and not try to modify it or supplement it in any respect? Does it somehow not fit Illinois conditions or what?
Well, I think certainly, Your Honor, there is a particular concern in Illinois about disclosure.
Right, so point me to a departure from the federal standard that reflects some particular Illinois concern.
One departure, for example, is that The three points that the federal statute makes, the audience, the time period, the clearly identified candidate, refer to clearly identified candidate targeted to the relevant electorate, those three mirror the federal standard.
Well, not identically. You don't have a limit on your target, you know.
Again,
don't have
true. We don't have a numerical. There's no numerical limit.
So why that departure?
Because, Your Honor, we don't have an FCC that will provide the information. We don't have the targeted for the relevant electorate in the federal standard talks about there are 50,000. There's a 50,000 possible audience for this broadcast, and the FCC will tell you. You can go to the FCC. They will tell you what whether it matches this 50% or $50,000. 50,000 person possible audience. You know, we don't have those authorities, but you can look when you read
do you mean you don't have it?
Have an FCC to tell you, you know, exactly who is 50,000, and also 50,000 is for the 50,000 limit is for the person who represents at least in a representative capacity 650,000 people. So that would be, you know, approximately 10% of the electorate. So if the board would reasonably interpret that to be if your broadcast is receivable
I'm lost. I don't understand. So
I thought you were just saying that the Illinois law is targeted to the smaller scope of the electorates for state and local races.
That is what I'm saying.
A different number.
So you would have a different number, yes.
You have a different number.
But again, for the federal elections, that you only really have, it's focused on the senator race and the representative race. Here, a local race can be an electorate of 2,000, perhaps, maybe smaller, you know, and so a school district or so. It can be in the very small thousands. So the idea is to target to the relevant electorate is to a similar proportion of the relevant electorate.
But there's no proportionality.
There's no explicit proportionality in that. But again,
an explicit proportionality. Proportionality is important. Why isn't it in statute?
Because I don't know the answer to that. I would assume that the General Assembly believed that the State Board of Elections would interpret it in a reasonable way, and this is the reasonable way. This is what targeted means.
I see about some of these terms. I don't understand. What's the difference between concert and cooperation? Made in concert or cooperation with or at the request of any of a political committee. What is that? What's the difference between concert and cooperation?
I would believe it's a matter of degree.
What does that mean, degree? Which is the higher degree?
Oh, I would think in concert would be a more affirmative united action. But again, it would be the bottom line. And again, and this interestingly,
it would be the bottom line.
Well,
what are you talking about?
If I may, the plaintiff says that the federal regulations are explicit about concerted action and the state is not. But in fact, if you look at those at the federal regulation 100.109.21, I believe it is, and you see what it has is three categories. It has the paying, who pays, which is the committee. It has a content regulation or content component, and it has a content component and I'm having trouble here. It has a content component, which is, interestingly enough, electioneering. Electioneering communication is a content. And in addition, it has the cooperation component, which includes a suggestion. One of the possibilities is a suggestion, exactly the sort of thing that the statute here applies. So while it's true that the Illinois statute isn't...
It should be interpreted in light of the federal regulation?
Yes, I'm saying because...
Why didn't you adopt the federal regulation? If you like the federal regulation, why didn't you adopt the federal regulation?
Well, I think that the federal regulation is designed for... I would say it's extremely complicated, and it's designed more for people who are working on a national or at least statewide level. And here, this is really designed for the local elections and designed for, shall we say, a less sophisticated. And it's understood.
In this part of your statute, it says, made in concert or cooperation with or at the request, suggestion, or knowledge of the candidate. But won't the candidate always be aware? Won't he always have knowledge of what these groups are doing?
Well, not knowledge. Obviously, if there's an ad broadcast, the candidate could know. Somebody would probably tell him. But this is more. This again is as the district court was explaining. It's about affirmative action with
no,
the candidate.
No, affirmative acquiescence. This is another.
Acquiescence,
bad English.
I agree with.
Acquiescence is what you do afterwards. It's not pre.
I agree.
Inserted.
I agree.
Then what does this mean? What is the basis for your thinking that this means somehow advanced knowledge, that the candidate knows this is going to be done?
Because when you look at the word in context, all of those words are words that would take actions that would take place in advance of the communication.
Could you give us an example? Because I have the very same problem that my brother to my left has. Can you give me an example of what that might mean in practice? What affirmative acquiescence might possibly mean, because I can't.
Again, affirmative acquiescence doesn't appear in the statute, but
that's what Judge Hart construed.
Right, and I think he, as Judge Posner pointed out, I think the acquiescence is inaccurate because it does imply a post hoc rather than
It's got to be
action.
Prior knowledge, right?
Exactly.
In context, because any other requirement would be nonsense.
Right.
And it presumably would also have to involve some private communications.
Presumably, yes.
Because if there's...
Wait. Where's the private communication? Yeah. That's not in your statute.
Again, I think if you have to construe these words...
You've just confused everything. Look, I have another problem. I don't get this in connection business. A contribution is defined as, anything of value knowingly received in connection with any question of public policy. But then political action committee is defined in terms of expenditures on behalf of or in opposition to a candidate. How does on behalf of or in opposition square with in connection? In connection is much broader.
Right, and that's why it's limited.
What's limited by what? I don't get you.
Well, the you have to look when you're deciding whether you're a political committee based on your contributions or expenditures. You have to look at both definitions. The on behalf of
precisely they're the two. So how do they relate? In connection with is not a synonym for on behalf of or in opposition to.
Correct.
So what is the committee supposed to do when it looks at these two inconsistent definitions of the same word?
I think
contribution.
Well, I don't think that they're inconsistent. I think that they are.
They're inconsistent. In connection with does not mean on behalf of or in opposition to.
No, it doesn't mean it. No, exactly. It doesn't mean it.
That's the problem. You have two definitions of contribution, and they're inconsistent because one of them is much broader than the other and has nothing to do with support or opposition, just connected.
Right, but again, that contribution that's in connection with doesn't make you a political committee or expenditure,
But it's a contribution.
Right, it's a contribution, but it's not the kind of contribution that will make you a political committee unless it's on behalf of the candidate or the issue. Remember the ballot issue. Remember that these words, this is not 1970. We're not looking at these words in a vacuum. We're looking at these words after Buckley, after most importantly McConnell, which said that the words used for electioneering communications here are objective and clear. So that, you know, so it's no surprise that the Illinois legislature adopted that wording.
What work does in connection with, if you didn't have that definition of contribution, then this subsection D would be much clearer. So why did they add in connection with, right? It would be just contributions on behalf of or in opposition. That's reasonably clear by the standards of this statute. So why did they add this thing about in connection with?
Your Honor,
don't know? You don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we know that amending statutes is not an easy task and has been compared to sausage. What the General Assembly does is perhaps more of a belt and suspenders approach, but that doesn't make it unconstitutionally vague.
The alternative, which was to adopt the federal statute. Now, maybe you had to have some modifications involving
numbers.
Involving the targeting. Now, what is this? There's this argument in the briefs over the internet. So, if some political message is put up on the web, so suppose it's put up on the web and years ago, and now an election comes along, and within the 30 days or the 60 days, and it's still there. And suppose the committee had wanted to take it down, and maybe it did take it down, but it's still up there, right? Because there are all sorts of services that will preserve on the internet messages that have been removed by the person who posted them. So what's the status of those?
Well, remember, Your Honor, again, it has to be and, you know, referring to a clearly identified candidate within the 60 or 30 days, you know, susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than...
Sure, but it may have referred to this candidate the last time he ran.
Right.
It was posted, and it's
right.
Up there. It's still up there. So is that within the scope of the statute or not?
Generally, Your Honor, yes, I believe it would be. When it's receivable.
What if the person who posted it had removed it from his website, but it's on other websites?
Well, then the original speaker is no longer the speaker, so it's not attributed to that.
Make that distinction.
Well, it's made by the political committee. If it's made by a third party, it's not made by
you. It was made by the political committee.
Initially.
No. It was made by the political committee. It is its work. You know, Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare, even though he's dead, right?
That's a secret communication between us.
If you
don't even consider that.
Right? But it's reproduced by other people, you know, and it's posted and so on. You still have the original author. Right?
That's true. But for purposes of the statute,
suppose the legitimate, you know, political the campaign says, oh, this CFIF, whatever CIF, they posted this great campaign post years ago for X, who's our candidate. And they took it down and so on, but, you know, it's still there. We have it. So we're going to run it. Now, does that put CIF in violation?
No, because certainly
Why
as...
Why not? Because they created it. Where in the statute would they be let off the hook?
Because it says that the political committee is the one that is making the communication.
It made the communication. It put it on the
right. But if someone else is repeating it,
right.
if you tell me, you know, God is dead, and I go out and tell somebody else God is dead, you're not speaking. I'm speaking because I'm the second speaker, even if I'm repeating what you said. No?
Well, you are speaking.
Right. I become the speaker because I've adopted your...
Someone republishes a Shakespeare play. It's not Shakespeare speaking.
I think there's a difference, Your Honor, between author and speaker.
Why?
Because this statute regulates and wants disclosure from the speaker, not from a third party.
I thought the focus was on who's spending the money to spread the message at any given time.
Well, exactly.
And that's what's the difference between the first and the second speaker.
Well, that's also correct, because this is about who is doing the speaking and who's paying for the speech. I mean, that's the purpose of these disclosure statutes. And although
you're creating a big loophole, because suppose CIF, outside of the 30 or 60 day period, it makes all these inflammatory campaign ads, but it's not liable because it's outside the 60 days.
Correct.
But it posts them. It's up there. They're sitting there. And when the campaign starts, the candidates and the parties, they broadcast these. They run them on their own websites.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a violation?
A violation? Does it require disclosure?
Yeah, because it had created all these things outside the 60-day period, knowing, hoping that they'd be picked up later. By the candidate.
Right. First of all, remember,
would that be a violation by CIF or not?
This isn't about
would
violations.
Violation?
Would it trigger
would
disclosure?
Would that be a violation or not by CIF?
It's not about violations. Would it trigger disclosure for CIF, for the center? No, because they would not be the person who is making the communication.
Huge loophole.
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
Might I mention another one? What I've been thinking about is the difficulty in determining whether a blog post on a nationally oriented website that, you know, regarding an upcoming election in Illinois would or would not be considered to be targeted at Illinois voters, for example.
Mm-hmm. Let's say the center has an advertisement or a communication on its website, a posting that says, "We think that if you agree with our positions, you should vote for candidate X, an Illinois candidate." So yes, that would certainly be targeted to the relevant electorate, because it would be sent to. It would be receivable by Illinois. It would be assuming it's within the day, you know, the certain number of days, it refers to the clearly identified candidate, as I just did. So, yes, the answer would be yes. Right.
That's a little surprising. If CIF, suppose it has no office in Illinois, has no actual interest in Illinois, But it publishes a list of, you know, candidates that all over the country that support agrees with its policies, and so it would be dragged into Illinois.
Well, but you'd also have to, again, there are the additional requirements. There's the financial requirement, for example, the $3,000, soon to be $5,000 within 12 months.
$3,000 in Illinois, doesn't it?
With regard to Illinois candidates, I mean, certainly we can't ask for disclosure when they're talking about candidates in Indiana. We don't have any interest in doing that.
It's talking about, it's got, makes a list of candidates it likes all over the country. This is
right.
Really just Judge Rovner's question. Makes this list, or, you know, list of policies that it likes and so on that it ascribes to particular candidates. And it puts it on its website, and it collects money from all over the country. Maybe gets more than $3,000 from Illinois.
If it took in contributions within the meaning of contributions, if it took in contributions from Illinois, you know,
Well, you know, if it's the Heritage Foundation or any of the, or you know, American Enterprise Institute or Brookings or so on, they probably get contributions in that magnitude from many, many different states. And they may say things, you know, someone might write a report for Brookings about the best, the most, say, progressive or enlightened politicians in the country. They might say nice things about candidates, people happen to be candidates in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to make all these disclosures?
Well, again, Your Honor, it would depend on whether they either received or spent $3,000 in relation to those.
They receive it, but they receive it because there are people in Illinois who support Brookings. They don't receive it from
People who support Brookings are not necessarily contributors within the meaning of the Act.
Not necessarily? What is a contributor? A contributor is someone who makes a contribution, right? And a contribution is just
with
anything in connection with public
policy. In connection with the election. Well, it's something on the ballot, so a candidate or a matter of public policy on the ballot, a tax referendum or something.
As I say, some of the people Brookings talks about in its reports happen to be on an Illinois ballot. They probably don't even know it, but, right? But they're sucked into this disclosure requirement. That'd be kind of, if you start going after national organizations, that's going to be a real mess.
Well, this actually goes back to the threshold question, I suppose, of justiciability. There hasn't, you know, whether the plaintiff has a well-founded fear of being sucked into this. And
does have a well-founded fear.
Well, it certainly says it's apprehensive, but that its donors won't donate if it's going to be disclosed. But the question is whether what they fear will come to pass, if there's a reasonable probability of that. And, you know, they haven't shown that Illinois has a history, any kind of history, of interpreting it the way that they say that they fear. And again, if you look at, you know, the plaintiff sort of wants to go back to the Buckley days. The plaintiff is ignoring the fact that the functional equivalent of express advocacy, that is to say, communications that have, you know, no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a candidate or an issue, which is explicitly within the statute, we incorporated, you know, Wisconsin Right to Life's understanding of functional equivalent of express advocacy. So but life has gone on since Buckley.
Individual Freedom has reported spending a total of $2,519,000 on independent candidates through October 2010, with 100% benefiting Republican candidates, right? And then they have a list. So don't you think they have a well-founded fear that they're going to be sucked in because they support all these Republicans? It could be Democrat. It wouldn't make any difference, obviously.
Right. It wouldn't make any difference. And no, I don't, because there hasn't been, and plaintiff, I'm sure, looked very hard to find the sort of enforcement of the statute that it fears, and it doesn't. It hasn't found it. There isn't any. You know, the statute hasn't been enforced in this ad hoc.
Is it a matter of discretion by Illinois, or is it a matter of the limitations of the statute?
It's the matter of the limitations of the statute.
You have perfectly good examples of where the statute would, as you and the statute would, ingest these out-of-state actors.
Well, because the out-of-state actors inject themselves into Illinois politics.
Well, that's what they're doing, right? Yeah.
Well, I don't know that they've injected themselves into Illinois, but again,
all these people they like all over the country.
I mean, I think, you know, the plaintiff looks to its vagueness standards is to eliminate uncertainty, and we know from Wisconsin Right to Life itself that there's uncertainty. Some justices thought the ads that were at issue in that case.
You had this safe harbor, and you didn't take it.
Your Honor, I believe that we have taken it with regard to
all sorts of changes.
Yes, but those changes haven't pushed it away from the safe harbor.
No. Okay, thank you, Ms. Wells. So, Mr. Kirby, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Your Honors, normally at this stage of the argument, I like to be able to say the issues being clear, I will submit. In this case, I think I'm going to say the issues being perfectly unclear, and that being our point, I will submit.
Okay. Well, actually, Mr.
I'm
Kirby,
sorry.
If we could, one of the questions that you raised had to do with non-electioneering communications having to do with, you're arguing about uncertainty about ballot initiatives in their early stages.
Yes, Your Honor.
And expenditures that would not involve electioneering communications. Could you give me an example of what your clients would like to do with respect to potential ballot initiatives that would be discouraged?
What would happen, Your Honor, is if we want to talk out on issues that potentially are going to become the subject of ballot initiatives, but let's say haven't yet. The way the statute is written, if we're busy speaking out on, suppose we're pushing hard on there should be a balanced budget in Illinois or something like that, and there's some ballot initiative that's going to double the retirement fund for policemen or build libraries or something, so that one at least implies the other should be rejected. Our speech about the policy issue that affects the ballot initiative and therefore tends to support or oppose it would be swept in, even though we haven't said there's a ballot initiative, vote for it or against it. Now, I know it's hard to believe, but that's the way the statute is written. All you have to do is have speech that tends to support or tends to oppose something that may become a ballot initiative. And that inhibits a great deal of policy speech.
Do you think that's a realistic interpretation of the statute?
Unfortunately, I do, Your Honor. And like I say, I've been doing this for 20 years. I've been in front of the ethics committees of many states, and I have found people who somehow see perfectly clearly that this ad supported or opposed this person or this ballot initiative, even though I advise the client, don't worry about it, nobody could possibly think that, you're fine. The answer is yes, you need clear lines. You can't have this kind of, well, doesn't really feel right, and probably they won't go there. That's the whole difference between First Amendment statutes regulating the First Amendment, and statutes regulating traffic speed, for example. So I'm sorry to say
I take it you'd have no trouble applying the statute to efforts, for example, to gather signatures.
I would have no trouble drafting a statute that spoke of those kinds of efforts. But applying the present statute, I'm not sure whether it would apply to efforts to collect signatures or not. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I haven't thought about it in light of the text of the statute. It's an interesting question, but I just haven't thought about it.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much to Mr. Kirby and Mr. Wells.